the brethren in Philippi. He was talking to them in chapter 2 about Christ and his great sacrifice. And one of the things that he said is, have this mind in you, which was also in Jesus Christ. And I think that's where God always starts. I think God says it is critically important that we have the right perception of things first. That we get a grasp on where we ought to be mentally if we're going to follow that up with some kind of action. And once he said, have the mind of Christ, then he described the things that Jesus did because of the mind that he had. He had a mind of a servant, and so he displayed that in what he did. And I think if you look through the book of Philippians, you're going to see about 10 different times that God talks about the mind that we have, or the mindset that we have. And I think that's because he does that all the time, saying, here's what I need you to do. I need you to get into the right state mentally so that you're understanding the right thing, because that's what's going to stimulate everything that follows. And that's kind of where this lesson is. All of these lessons today are intended to be lessons where you give feedback at different times. So I hope you will help me with that and that you'll participate, because it makes the class both more interesting and it stimulates our thought process, I think, a little bit better when we do that. The next two lessons in particular are that way. What does she want from me anyway? And what does he need now? Are both lessons that deal with the male-female aspect of marriage. This lesson will have some of that feedback, but it really is just to try to get us thinking the right way. Because this, I would tell you, this lesson is the basis for the rest of the entire series. It's fundamental that way. There always have been things in God's Word that are more fundamental. Jesus was asked on one occasion, what's the greatest command? He answered that, didn't he? I mean, there would be a tendency sometimes in us to say, if we hadn't read that passage, now we've read that passage so we can respond to that, but there would be a tendency, had we not read that passage, to say all of God's commands are equal. All of God's commands are equally great, which in one sense is true. Everything he tells us has an equality that way. But Jesus responded to that question and said what? What's that? He said the greatest. What is? And so what was the greatest? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, mind and strength. He says, and then there's a second, even like unto that, love your neighbor as yourself. Why did he say those were the greatest? Do you remember what his reasoning was? He said they're foundational. And in particular, when he referred back to all the previous teaching, what did he say? Upon these two hang all the law and the prophets. So he's just saying, it's not that they're more important because other commands are less important. They're more important because it is more fundamental. It's like an umbrella. He said, these two commands cover everything else God ever told us to do. If you love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and you love your neighbor as yourself, that has encompassed everything else he's ever asked us to do. Following the specifics become easier, and that's what we'll do with this lesson as well. Talked about finding God in your marriage, and that becomes a very important thing, because sometimes we just look at marriage in slightly the wrong way. Socrates said, by all means marry. If you get a good wife, you'll become happy. If you get a bad one, you'll become a philosopher. So that's pretty telling, isn't it? So what's marriage for? Why do we get married? What are the reasons for marriage? Anybody? Reasons for marriage. God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. So that would be probably on the companionship side for one thing. It actually is on several sides. But he saw that it was not, which is interesting, you know, in all of God's creation, to look at everything and say, wow, that's good. That is good. That is good. And then to look at something and God in his own creation say, that's not good. He said this is important. He created that because it was a necessary part of his creation. Other reasons for marriage? Yes? Helps you to glorify God better. It doesn't mean I can't glorify God as a single, but I need to think, and we're going to go that direction in a minute, thinking in terms of how does it do that within marriage. Other purposes, other reasons to get married. For procreation. God says that we were to get married, and he said people are to repopulate the earth. We're intended to produce children through marriage and only through marriage. That's what he desires for us. Other things.
In times past, a woman found it important to be married in order to have support.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole structure, we're studying the book of Ruth right now in a class we're doing back at Nashua, and understanding what it meant to have no husband for a woman in that society is far different than what we've got. And so he created that because that was the way the structure was supposed to work in a physical way. Other reasons? Absolutely. And it's always funny because anytime I ever do this series anywhere, that's always the last one to be brought up, but probably not the last one to be thought of. We're a little slow sometimes to say, you know, God created it so that we could be sexually fulfilled. He says the marriage bed, let it be undefiled, but that's a good thing. And he talks in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 about that whole relationship that we have one with another. Sexual fulfillment is not some kind of ugly or hidden thing. It is God created. He wouldn't have made it pleasurable if he hadn't intended that it be pleasurable for us. So it's a part of the marriage, and he said, but it's the only rightful way to fulfill that. A lot of different things that we have marriage for. But I want us to go a little bit different direction when we think about that this morning first. There's a couple, Gary and Betsy Ricucci, who have written several books. They said, one of the best wedding gifts God gave you was a full-length mirror called your spouse. Had there been a card attached, it would have said, here's to helping you discover what you're really like. Amen. We asked the question last night and when we were dealing with the college age group, or just actually made the point. Most of them don't yet understand because they're not yet married. So instead I pointed at Chuck and asked him, how many of you have learned something about your spouse after you got married you didn't know before you got married? Oh, I assure you that happens. That happens. You're going to find out some things. Living together with somebody 7 days a week, 24 hours a day is considerably different than dating somebody. We talked about that. And so you're going to find out some things. You're going to find out some habits they had that maybe you didn't even know that they had. All kinds of things. But that's not as critical as a statement that was made by Kathleen and Thomas Hart. Said, sometimes what is hard to take in the first years of marriage is not what we find out about our partner, but what we find out about ourselves. How many of you have learned something about yourself since you got married that you didn't really recognize or notice or take note of before you got married? Anybody? That fits your description? Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a guy by the name of Gary Thomas who wrote a book called Sacred Marriage. Great book. As a matter of fact, this lesson is based off of some premises that he sets forth in that book. He said when he was in, I think it was ninth grade, he was voted most polite kid in his class. You remember when they had those kind of awards? Most humorous, most polite, most likely to succeed. I don't recall receiving any of those, but some people did. He said, I got most polite. And it's interesting, he said, because I thought that was a fair award, he said. He said, because I'd been raised by my parents to be very polite, and I was. He said, yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and he responded, and he opened doors. He said he thought that was very good. He says, and it wasn't until I was married that I learned how difficult I could be. And so he said, he asked his wife on one occasion, do you love me? She says, oh, you know I love you. He says, how much do you love me? She said, I love you with all my heart. He says, I don't need that much. He said, all I need is 7 seconds. And she looked at him and said, 7 seconds? He said, that's how long it takes to refill the ice cube tray. Now, I know I'm dealing with a generation that's never seen an ice cube tray. But there used to be, it didn't always come out the door. You do understand that, don't you? You used to actually have to put water in a tray, the old plastic kind. And before the plastic, there's some in here I know that remember the metal ones that you had to pull the handle up and crack the ice. He said, I've timed it. That's how long it takes to fill the tray and put it back in the freezer. Well, apparently she didn't have the habit of filling it and putting it back in the freezer. And he said, and then I asked myself, could I possibly have become that picky or that petty? Yes, I had. He said, I never would have, but all of a sudden, within the marriage, that just annoyed him to death. That kind of thing happens in marriage. Sometimes we get annoyed, and it's because we've got the wrong perception, I think, of the way that things are supposed to work. And so we're going to fight a battle that is certainly, I think, the problem that really the entire world faces, not only in marriage, but with anything else. Helen Rowland said, marriage is the operation by which a woman's vanity and a man's egotism are extracted without anesthetic. I like that description of marriage. It isn't always easy, and we'll talk about that this week. It'd be great if it was always just easy, but we have a problem with the whole idea of what it is for. Is it for procreation? Yes. Is it for sexual fulfillment? Yes. Is it for companionship? Yes. Is it for structure? Yes. There's incredible benefits in that. One of the things that I say in a lot of wedding ceremonies that I do is that helping a couple understand, here's one of the great advantages of marriage. Every joy is doubled. Every sorrow is halved. That's a great benefit. Somebody to share with on both the good and the bad side. Both of those things are good. There's a lot of benefits, but that's not the focus. What I'm saying is, what did God make marriage for? What did He create? Not just, in other words, once you're married, what does He want? What is it that I'm looking at as far as a goal of marriage, and how do I make that the way that it should be? We live in a country that has as some of its foundational principles life, liberty, and what? I want you to just think about that for a minute. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so we've created a society where we think in those kind of terms, even about marriage. Am I happy? Am I going to be happy? When I counsel with couples, multiple times is that the discussion that it revolves around. People come and say, you know what, I'm just not happy. In other words, that's what they're striving for. They're striving for the happiness. We're in a culture that caters to that, wouldn't you agree? In the materialistic side, in the emotional side, everything is about how is it that I can have satisfaction? How is it that I can have happiness in marriage? And I think marriage kind of starts that way. Just think about the way typical marriage starts. In the sense of, here's the story of romance, as we see it on TV or read it in stories or whatever else. But a guy meets girl, and suddenly the heart begins to beat a little bit faster. There's a particular attraction between these two. It's like a knight in shining armor has come into her life, and she has this picture of him riding down on that large white steed, and she's on the hillside, and he sweeps her up and throws her onto the back of the horse and takes her off into the sunset. And as all the movies and all the stories always say, what is it? And they lived happily ever after. We think in those kind of terms. She thinks, you know what, this is the guy who's going to be sensitive and he's going to be warm. He's going to listen to all my needs and he's going to know what those are and he's going to seek to fulfill all those. He's going to sacrifice his interest on behalf of what I need and want in my life. And he's not much different. He gets to that point and he drops that rock. You know, he gets down on one knee maybe and pops open that case, and she sees it, and all of us, just seems like no time after that, she's publicly declaring, and he's publicly declaring in front of all kinds of people that they are in love, and that they are going to be united and spend the rest of their life together. And then a few months down the road, reality sets in. They find out it isn't exactly like they thought it was going to be. Guys aren't any different. We fall in love. We think she's the most gorgeous woman in the world, and we're attracted to her, and we think she's going to fix all our meals and take care of the clothes, and she's going to be ready for, like, in the, remember the old Rocky movie where he's hanging in the doorway, yo, Adrian, toward the end of that movie, that she's going to put the kids to bed and clean up all the dishes, and then she's going to put on her negligee, and, 10:30 at night, she's going to be ready for intimacy. Guys, our minds may be going different directions, but both of us are seeking and thinking in terms of, it is going to provide to me, marriages, provide to me the missing part of my life. And we think in those kind of terms. But we find out it just doesn't work out quite that way. Sooner or later, the myth explodes. And here's why. Here's why I think that that's the case. God wants us to understand that, oops, that picture should have disappeared. And I have no idea why it did not. So let's just read those to you, since you're not going to be able to see those. The first one says, happiness is not the goal. Not even here on earth. Happiness is not the goal. It can't be the goal. It's the wrong goal. It's the wrong approach to life. Happiness is, in fact, not only is it not the goal, it is a byproduct, or it's a result of a life properly lived. Happiness is the end game. That's important. We mentioned last night, somebody in the class talked about the idea of getting to heaven. And sometimes if you ask a Christian, what's your greatest goal in life? Christians will sometimes respond to that. I want to get to heaven. That's my goal. And I always tell people, I think that's the, I personally, you can disagree with me, but I think that's the wrong goal. I think that's the result of the, what your goal ought to be. Your goal ought to be that I seek to please God and glorify God in everything that I do and draw closer to God. And if I do that, I will go to heaven because that's what He's promised me. I'm not seeking my reward. I'm seeking my diligent service to Him. And He will reward me for that. And sometimes we get the rewards mixed up with what the goal should be. And we do that in life. Happiness is not the goal. In Matthew chapter 5, the section that we call the Beatitudes, the whole point is he's talking about happiness or contentment or blessedness in a lot of different realms, isn't he? And what does he say? He says, you know what? Strive to be happy. No. What's he say? Blessed are what? Where does he start? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Don't strive to be blessed. Don't strive to be happy. Strive to be what? Poor in spirit. He says, if you're poor in spirit, if I think less of myself, that's what produces the happiness, the contentment. I would tell you that is a key to marriage. The whole concept of where our focus is becomes critical. Abraham Lincoln was walking with a couple of his sons on one occasion, both boys crying. And as they were crying, somebody stopped him on the sidewalk and said, Mr. Lincoln, why are the boys so unhappy? And he said, he had one hand closed. He said, the boys have got the same problem the whole world has. And he opened up his hand. He said, I've got three walnuts. Both boys want two. We get a little selfish, don't you think? And I would tell you, in marriage, we get a little selfish. Happiness is destroyed when I start thinking about myself. Why was it that Jesus was able to be content? He was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And yet, when he prayed for his disciples, he says, I pray that you may have my joy in you. That joy may be absolutely complete. Would you describe Jesus as an absolutely content and joyful person? Just nod your heads or anything. Yes, that's the right answer. Yes. He was. Did he ever have sorrow in his life? Yes. But did it remove his contentment and joy in life? No, it did not. Why? Because Jesus wasn't focused on Jesus. I don't have the issue of my happiness nearly as much when I'm not focused on me. If I've already not considered myself the same way, and so that's what we're going to talk about this weekend, is how it is that we get the right approach to our marriage. And so the question becomes, what if God designed marriage to make us holy rather than to make us happy? I don't think God made marriage to make you happy. I'm not saying He doesn't expect you to be happy in your marriage. That's two different things. I think God says, I didn't give you a wife just so you could be happy. I gave you a wife so you can be who you're supposed to be. And I'm telling you, if you will be who you're supposed to be, you'll be happy. You'll be content. And I would tell you so much so that it doesn't even matter whether the other person responds in the same way that they're supposed to or they don't. In Ephesians chapter 5, anybody ever remember in school, and you guys are close enough that you ought to still remember these, we used to do those if-then clauses. That if certain things were true, then this was the conclusion. It would naturally be true. You remember doing some of those if-then clauses? One of the challenges I give all the couples that I'm counseling with before they get married, one of the challenges I give them is I tell them to go home and read Ephesians 5, and I want you to write down all the if-then clauses that are in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 through the end of the chapter where it talks about marriage. Write all those down. We're going to talk about those next week. How many are there? There are zero. He doesn't say, Mark, love Judy, your wife, if she does this. Mark, love her if she does this. Judy, submit to Mark if he does this. That isn't the basis of it. It is, I am a husband, I'm supposed to do certain things. She is a wife, she's supposed to do certain things. We understand that logic, don't we? We're studying the Sermon on the Mount in another class we're doing right now, and it's interesting that Jesus talks about the righteousness of the Pharisees. And he says, you know what? If Chuck's real good to me and he's real friendly toward me, how hard is it for me to be friendly back? Not very difficult, is it? But Jesus said that's kind of like the Pharisees. Or that's like the Gentiles or anybody else. He says anybody in the world can be good to the people who are good to them. That's not the issue. But because you're a Christian, he said, who are you supposed to be good to? those who mistreat you. It's not just even a generic everybody. He specifically says, your enemies, those who persecute you, those who mistreat you. He says, I should still act the same way toward them. Why? Because of them? No. Because of my relationship with God. That's what marriage is. You ought to be who you are in your marriage, not because of the person you're married to, but because of God. And I think He made it for us to be holy. It isn't made to be easier. It's made to be holy. And so how do I become? That quote from the Ricucci's that said, here's that full-length mirror. How do I, through my spouse, become a better person? That's the key. How do I become a better person? And that's important because what you're going to find out this weekend as we talk about these different subjects. Women struggle with this a little more than men do on this end. Women take on men as projects sometimes. You know, he's got these flaws, but I think I can work him through those. You know, I can correct him. That's more of a thing that you'll find women struggling with. In the sense of thinking, I'm going to change him. I'll just clue you in on the front end. You're not changing anybody. He can change him. You might encourage him to change. You might even show him the way to change, but you can't change him. He can't change you. If we accept that fact, then we'll get the focus where it needs to be. Who can I change? I can only change myself. And so if I'm the only person that I can change, where do I need to concert all my effort? On me. I need to put all the effort here on me. Put the effort forth to make me who I'm supposed to be. And that's kind of what this weekend is about. And it's important to understand that because romance is new. Romance is new. That's a relatively modern pursuit. We talked about in that class last night, Rebecca and Isaac in Genesis chapter 24. Isn't that one of the most romantic stories you've ever heard? Send your servant. Tell your servant to find a wife. The servant says, God, here's what I need for help. If you'll just point me toward the woman who will give water to my camels, we are ready to go with this plan. So he goes, and we talked about that last night. You know, that story is more incredible than we think sometimes on a lot of different levels. Camels drink up to about 21 gallons of water per feeding. So 21 gallons of water for the camel. There were 10 camels there. She said, I'll feed all of them. I'm thinking she was carrying water for a little while. She was beautiful, but from somebody that was in the class last night, what did Isaac not know and why? She was veiled, verse 65 says. Before Isaac ever met her, she covered her face up. He did not see her beauty. She was beautiful, but it wasn't based on beauty. And Isaac marries her because she is not from the Canaanite women. She is going to be somebody that can help him. She is somebody that has got a mindset of caring and concern and service to others. And so they get married, and that's God's idea. We, at our marriage retreat, one of them we did, and I can't even remember which one it was. I'm thinking, was it Missouri? Where was it? Oh, Florida, thank you. Which is another thing. Women remember everything, as we'll see. Men remember nothing. As far as details. At our Florida marriage retreat, we had a couple there that was from an arranged marriage. First couple I've ever met. I know there's a lot of them around, but I'm saying first couple I've ever met. They had been married a pretty long time. They talked about some of the struggles they went through, but they were continuing to work on their marriage because divorcing was never an option for them. They never even considered that. So that was just foreign to me. That was foreign to most everybody that was there. We don't think in terms of marrying somebody we didn't fall in love with, do we? I mean, our society has made the romantic side of the pursuit a very strong point. I'm not against romance. We'll talk about where that plays its role within marriage, but that's a relatively modern pursuit. God said, here's what I need. I need two people who are dedicated to me beyond all else. And if you've got a man and a woman who are dedicated to me beyond all else, they can make marriage work the way God intended marriage to work. And I would tell you, every marriage that fails, is either one or the other who no longer has a complete heart dedicated to God, or both. We can work through things, and that's what causes people. And we'll talk about some of those issues as we go. So we're not saying romance shouldn't be a part. We're just saying it needs to be the right part. We need to understand what it is. So what we want to talk about is how do we set the right goals? What are the goals? Romance doesn't work because it's just no elasticity to it. There is no elasticity to romance at all. It's just the wrong goal. You can't survive on romance and feelings. Why? Why won't it survive on romance and feelings? What's that? Absolutely, your feelings change. How many people in here have children? How many of you here have children that are at least past 2 or 3 years old? How many of you love your children with all your heart? Now, hopefully everybody raised their hand for that. There were a couple hands a little slow coming up that time. I'll give you a chance to put it up slowly. That shouldn't have been the question to do it to, though. We love our children. How many of you at times aren't so fond of your children? Yeah, there have been times where you feel that sentiment that says, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. I didn't always like my kids. I'm saying the things that they did, the choices they made, the way they aggravated me. And my relationship with them, though, cannot be based on how I felt. Would you agree with that? Because if it had been based on how I felt, I might only have 2 sons now instead of 3. Who knows? But it can't be based on... What would it be like if my relationship with God was based on how he felt? Emotionally felt. What's that? Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I wouldn't even have had a relationship with him because it would have happened way before now. He would have never sent his son. I agree with that. If all his decisions had been based on feelings. But suppose his son had even come. You think there's ever been a time in my life where God says, you know what, Mark? You're done. Because I'm basing it on how I feel, not on my love for you. You know, God is stronger than that. And that's why we use that word agape love, a love that is beyond emotion. Doesn't mean there's no emotion in it, but we need to understand it can't survive on feelings because feelings change. As we said, there's no elasticity to romance, to feelings. It doesn't stretch. The kind of love that we need to have in marriage has to be a kind of love that stretches, that endures. When that child does something that just absolutely gets under your skin, or something that angers you because they've made a mistake that is just so directly against what you had said, aren't you glad you have a love that is stronger and will at least stretch to endure that? Love has to endure some tough things. Would you agree with that? And I'm telling you, in marriage, it's no different. It'd be great if we could say, you know what, your marriage can just click along and it'll never have a real test. But I'll tell you, it can have some tests. There are different things, and we'll get a chance to talk about some of those as we go along. When we strive for happiness, we strive for the wrong goal. We strive for the wrong goal. It's important that we strive for the right goal. And I would tell you, not only that I need to, instead of seeking happiness, I need to be seeking God in my marriage. How do I, if you're like me and male, then the question ought to be this weekend, how do I draw closer to God to become a more God-like husband in my life? How do I accomplish that? And I assure you, if I'm the God-like husband that I ought to be, hard to imagine that would not provide to my wife comfort and pleasure. She needs to ask the same question. How do I become a godlike spouse, wife to my husband? If we'll just focus on making sure we've got the goal right. Secondly, if I'm striving to get happiness from my wife, that's the wrong goal and from the wrong source. She cannot provide me happiness. She can provide me temporary pleasure. She can't provide me happiness. Why? What's that? Absolutely. Happiness comes from within. Wrong goal, wrong source. I'm going to have to make that choice, aren't I? She can change the outward circumstances, can make me superficially happy or pleased at a moment's time. But whether I am truly content, whether I am truly joyful, cannot be based on my circumstances. It has to be based on God. That Paul's point in Philippians again, as he's talking about those that were preaching Christ just to add to his problems in prison. That's just a bizarre concept to us, isn't it? He's in prison. There's people out there that are preaching the gospel. And they're saying, hey, let's go preach the gospel. You know why? Because they'll probably beat Paul some more because he stands up for this gospel. If we get out there and really preach it, it's going to be harder on him in prison. Hard for us to imagine that. And so Paul said what? Paul said, I hate those guys so badly. I wish God would just wipe them off the face of the earth. What did Paul say? He says, I rejoice in this. Whose choice was that? That's Paul saying for us, helping us to understand, you cannot view God or your spouse through your circumstances. You have to view all circumstances through the filter of God. We get things out of order. We allow God to be back here and the circumstances get between us and God. They can't do that. We have to make sure the circumstances are behind, that God is in our first line of vision. And so God is going to provide us with the happiness because He has changed us within, and we need to make sure that we grasp that part of it. And so here's what we want to do with the couple minutes that we have left. We want to talk about marital analogies in the Scriptures because I think this is a key. Marital analogies teach us truths about God. We talk about finding God in your marriage. God doesn't just choose words just for the sake of putting words there. We have a lot of different ways of referring to ourselves as His people, don't we? Give me some ways that we refer to ourselves. We are what? We are the family of God, or the household. We think of that, right? So there's one. Other things. What's that? We are the children of God. And that's very closely tied to the idea of the family. Other things that we are. We are the bride of Christ. What else? We're members of His body. Now, and we're the church. He talks about that, which is interesting because we normally refer to ourselves as the church more than anything else, don't we? The term that says the least about us is the term we choose to use the most. It just means the called out. I'm not saying it's not a good word. It is. But it says the least about our relationship to each other. It talks about our relationship in the sense of being away from the world and together. But why would he use an example like, and we say things like members of the church. You ever hear that phrase or use that phrase? That's just bad grammar as far as the structure of what it teaches. We're not members of the church that way. That makes it sound like a club or association or something. When God uses members, he says we're members of the body. He intends to portray something there, relationship-wise. You know, if somebody said he got dismembered, we would know what that meant, wouldn't it? He lost an arm or he lost a leg or something. He's trying to say members of the body are trying to give you a visual, how we're attached to one another, how we can't function without one another, how everything works integrally if it's working the right way. He says family or household, that's a relationship issue different than the idea of just saying the church. All those mean something. Well, look what he does in the Scriptures. He does the same thing. He views people as a husband views his wife. In Hosea chapter 2, in that day declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master, it says in verse 16. Did God cease to be their master? No, but he's going to use a different term. So why would he say, you're going to start calling me husband instead of master? I mean, he still was their master. Why would he tell them that? You're going to call me husband from now on. You're not going to call me master. I think that's exactly right. He wanted them to get a different view. View me differently. If you're thinking of a husband versus a master, and if wife, that seems to be the same thing to you, then don't raise your hand. If you get a different perception when somebody says husband versus master, God intends that, doesn't he? We understand that. He's saying, I want you to think of me in different terms. I want you to think about that relationship to me. He chooses words like that. And so he describes us as a married relationship throughout the Scriptures. I love the passage in Isaiah chapter 62 where he talks about God rejoices in his people in the sense of, it says, as a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will God rejoice over you. That's a great passage. How many of you remember men? I'm asking the men. How many of you men remember standing in the front of a building, maybe like this or some other kind of building, when your wife came through whatever doors in the back when they first started that processional to come down? You remember that? How many of you, and however many hands went up, all of them need to go up to this question. I'm just giving you a heads up, guys. How many of you, when you saw those doors open and saw her start to come down, thought, wow, this is just fabulous. Oh, look at those. See, they're going up high now. She's gorgeous. That is just a staggering sight. The emotions are stirring. That's what God says. God says, I want you to know how I feel about you. says, you know the way that you felt when she walked through the door? Your heart skipped a beat and you just thought, this is the most fabulous day of my life. God says, I rejoice like the bridegroom does over his bride. When he sees her coming down, God says, that's my relationship with you. Well, what's the purpose of that? He helps me understand something about this relationship that I've got, husband to wife. Because God doesn't lose that. Should I lose that? Or shouldn't I always feel that same way? The day she walked in with the wedding dress on and all the things that were going on that day and all the emotions that you felt, I had to look at my wife every single day and rejoice over her the same way. Why? Because she's my wife. God says, because you're mine. I feel that way about you because you are mine. He teaches us truths about marriage. And we're going to talk about one of them in particular a little bit later in the weekend. But marriage is the picture of reconciliation. It's just the picture of God saying, I want you to be joined back to me. You know, we were with God when we were born. Already relationship. We all understand, I think, and believe that in the purity and the innocence of our infanthood, we were God's children. Pre-sin, we knew that God looked at us with that kind of purity. Formed in purity, but deformed by sin. That's the whole picture of how our life goes. But then transformed by the blood of Christ. And he said, that's God saying, I want you back. I want to be reconciled to you. I want to make sure that people understand that we have that relationship together. And I think that becomes important because what we do is we strive for the right thing. I don't think in terms of what will make me happy, but what will make God happy. What's going to make God happy? If this is the analogy in marriage, that it is supposed to be like my relationship with Him. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. And I told the group last night that was there, we'll mention this more than once because I think this is so critical to the whole nature of what he's saying. I mean, the challenge in marriage has to be so utterly selfless. There's no question about that. In Ephesians chapter 5, when he's talking about what appears to be marriage, and talking about, in verse 22, wives submitting to your husbands and husbands loving your wives, and we'll dig into that a little bit more in the next two sessions. It's just so interesting to me that as preachers, we preach on marriage out of that passage regularly. And yet, what Paul said is, I want you to understand something. I'm not talking about marriage at all. Paul says, this isn't about marriage. That's just strange to read that passage the way it is. And Paul to follow that up in verse 32 saying, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now he said, all the examples I gave are true. Nevertheless, do what I told you to do. I'm not talking about marriage. That's not the main point here. That's not the main point. I'm talking about Christ and the church. What he needs me to understand is that the reason marriage is so critical is because he sets it up as the example by which we and others can understand the relationship we have with God. He said, that's what I want you to get a grasp of. And so the goal in marriage, as it is in all life, has to be to please God. How am I seeking to do that? The purpose for everything. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9, that's what Paul says. As in all things, we aim to please Him. Pleasing God. And so we need to understand, everything that I teach my children about God and reconciliation, they will understand through the filter of what they see as me as a husband and a father. Now, I'm not saying they can't overcome the bad examples I may set, but they're going to see everything through that filter first. Everything they see or understand about the concept of being faithful to one's spouse, they are going to see through the filter of my relationship with their mother, her relationship with me. They're going to see it through that filter first. Everything they understand, even about the faithfulness of God, is going to be viewed through their father. We have a lesson that's called Fathers on Earth as in Heaven. The same idea. That's the filter they're using. Everything that they're going to understand about God and His love for His betrothed is in fact going to be viewed through my promises and how I kept them, through my actions toward my wife, their mother. Everything's going to be through that filter. We have to understand that people are going to use your marriage and my marriage to understand something about God and His people. And let me tell you how I know that's true. Chuck mentioned that I'm good friends with Ralph Walker. Best friends. Outside of my wife, he's my best friend in the world, or at least in this world. But I didn't grow up in a home associated with Christ at all. Grew up in a completely dysfunctional, if you were to look up dysfunctional home, it could have very easily put a portrait of our family there. It was one of those homes destroyed and broken by alcoholism and abuse and everything you could imagine that you hear about. I mean, it just incredibly poor. None on my mother's side. I don't want anybody to leave here thinking, well, I wonder what his parents were like. It was none on my mother's side was that direction. My best friend at that time, when I was young, my best friend, his home was almost identical to mine. We had a third friend on the same block, and I have no idea if that was associated with the military families we're in and all the other kind of things and all the moving. I don't know what drove that in these people I'm with. But our other friend, the third one, almost the same home. So my association of normality was what I saw at home. I just thought that's the way marriage was. I thought people yelled and screamed and people did things they shouldn't do and people weren't kind to each other within the home. That's what I saw. Met and became best friends with Ralph Walker. Watched his family and realized there's a side of the world I've never seen before. And he spent 3 years trying to teach me the gospel. 3 years. I don't know if he was a poor teacher or if I was just a little stubborn. He'll be here in September. You can ask him which that was. I was less moved by his words. That wasn't his problem. That clearly was mine, I assure you. But I was less moved by his words than I was by seeing his family and seeing what it meant for a husband to love a wife, for a wife to love a husband, for a father to love his children and the children to love the father and vice versa with the wife as well, and to see a family unit. And I'm telling you that was the driving force that caused me to say, whatever it is that they have is what I want. Your marriage makes a difference. Makes a difference. And it is important that people be able to see God through your marriage. And for them to do that, you've got to make sure you find Him in your marriage and that He is the stimulating force. So I'm determined, absolutely determined, to not only keep my marriage together, but keep my marriage thriving. And it's not because doing so will make me happier, though I know it will. It'll make me happier if I do that. It's not because I want my kids to have a secure home, even though they're all gone and married as well. Not that I want them to have a secure place to come back to. Though I do want them to have that place to come back to. It's not because it would tear me apart to see my wife have to start over again and to go through the pains that go along with the whole idea of divorce and dissolution of marriage, but it would. It would break my heart to have to see that. The foremost reason that I want to make sure that my marriage is not only together but thriving is because I want somebody to be able to see what God means when He says that He wants to be married to us. That's the picture that I've got to take with me. So why do I become the kind of husband, why do you become the kind of wife you need to become? It isn't about your happiness. It's about let's help people see God. Find God in your marriage. We'll talk about the practical side of that with the lessons that followed this. Thank you so much for your attention.